Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How closely does your family's way of life match that of the community that surrounds it? And how do the differences and similarities shape the people we become? Growing up in the 80s and 90s, Gustavo Arellano did not give a lot of thought to those questions. Born in Southern California to immigrant parents, one undocumented, his ties to Mexican culture were a given, he says, but so was his Americanness. But as he grew older, Arellano began to realize it was harder for those with different backgrounds to take his blended identity for granted. That was never clearer than when he first wrote a joke column for his local weekly alternative. It eventually blossomed into a nationally syndicated column called Ask a Mexican, in which he promises to answer any and all questions posed by any and all readers about Mexican culture in the United States and the experience of Mexican Americans. His new memoir is called Orange County, A Personal History. Gustavo, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
I guess we should establish this right off the top. We're not allowed to call it the OC.
Is that right? No. You could call it OC, but not the OC. The only people who call it that are posers or executives for horrible television shows.
Is everybody upset about that show?
It's more of a term of annoyance for us in Orange County because, for the most part, I had never heard of it, nor had probably hundreds of thousands of people had ever heard of that term, until the creator of the television show, The O.C., said, oh, yeah, I think his name's Josh Whedon, or one of the producers said, oh, yeah, growing up in Newport Beach during the 1980s, everyone used that term. And even if anybody were to use that term, it would say a lot about what type of Orange County resident those people are, as opposed to the reality of Orange County.
Yeah, there are no Mexicans in that show, are there?
No, there are some Mexicans, but they're the house cleaners, they're the sexy gardeners, they're the pregnant girlfriend of the bad boy from Chino, and she's also from Chino. She's not from Orange County. So in those types of shows, in the historical stereotypes of Orange County, the Mexicans are always best out of sight, out of mind, or at the very least as laborers.
Is Orange County a bad place to be Mexican?
No, it's a it's a fun place to be Mexican, but I have a warped sense of humor. I grew up in Anaheim, California, which is, you know, home of Disneyland and the Anaheim Angels, which just lost yesterday. But growing up, it was perfectly fine to be Mexican. Everybody around me was Mexican. Even the white folks that I grew up with, the white kids, they were fine with us being Mexicans. But then once you get into the richer parts of Orange County, more toward the coast in Newport Beach, more toward those places that do make into national media, yeah, those places are kind of ugly to be Mexican. There's catcalls and fights and just, worst of all, there's just stereotypes, horrible stereotypes that people have about Mexicans. And, of course, the political efforts towards Mexicans, that's another story.
But La Naranja, as you call it sometimes in the book, is definitely changing demographically.
It has changed in really in the past 30 years. Historically, the stereotype for Orange County was that this was the apex point for white, wealthy conservative Republicans, that if you were to go to Orange County, it'd be nothing but boring suburbs, almost all filled with white people. That's just not the case anymore. Orange County now is a majority-minority county. In other words, whites make up less than 50% of the population. Latinos make up about a third, and then Asian Americans make up about 20% of the population. And if demographic trends hold true, Latinos will be the majority in about 30 years. And, you know, with us Latinos and our very fertile loins, you know it's going to happen.
Given your current occupation, Gustavo, I was really surprised that you didn't, you say that you didn't spend a lot of your youth sort of pondering what it meant to be the U.S.-born son of Mexican immigrants. Your life was what it was at that point.
Yeah, for most Mexican Americans, and I would think most children of immigrants, you grow up not giving a second thought to having your two feet in different cultures, being both Mexican, in my case, and American. It's just not something you grew up thinking about. In fact, really, the only criticism I ever got, probably until high school, about me being Mexican, was from Mexicans saying, you're not Mexican enough. In my book, I talk about just, you know, some of the more funnier aspects of that, of how my cousins and my uncles would insist that I dress like a quote-unquote Mexican, in other words, in Stetson and cowboy boots and belt buckles, but that I refused to do it because I didn't like how I looked in it. I've always worn glasses ever since second grade, and to put on, you know, I still don't think anybody could wear a Stetson and glasses and be taken seriously.
Yeah, you write in the book that at that point in your life, you dressed like a combination cholo and Poindexter with, like, khaki pants and a plaid shirt.
Oh, yeah, it's the uniform for any sort of hipper, more assimilated Mexican-American youth, at least out here in Los Angeles. So I got to say, every time, the couple of times I've been to Dallas and to Houston in Texas, people dress like that, too. You wear the crosshatch shirt, you wear Chuck Taylors, you probably have the horn-rimmed glasses. Really, it's just a brown hipster.
You seem to make a link in the book, Gustavo, between wealthy white people and disdain for being Mexican or being part of that culture. Do you find yourself even now sort of assuming that people of a certain class will make assumptions about you or about your family in particular?
Definitely. Wherever, you know, in my tours all around the United States, especially if I meet the richer people of a previous generation, sometimes they'll say, oh, you don't have an accent, or I'm glad you're not that type of Mexican, just small little things. Or, of course, when I tell them that both my parents, even though they've lived in this country for about 40-some years, that they still prefer to speak Spanish over English, then they assume, you're probably taking welfare and all that stuff as well. Over the weekend, the Dallas Morning News republished the op-ed piece I had done for the LA Times originally, where I was talking about how I was proud that my dad came to this country illegally. And so, of course, I got a lot of comments from people saying, oh, well, all of you were probably welfare babies and anchor babies, and you all started using free medical welfare. And I responded, no, you're making all these assumptions. My mom, she was Teamsters member for about 30-some years. So our medical benefits, they came out of her salary, frankly. We never, my dad, even when he was undocumented, he's now a citizen, but even when he was paying taxes because he knew that that's the right thing you had to do in this country. So still to this day, I will find those assumptions.
Your mom and dad both dropped out of school very young.
Yeah.
What were their expectations for you and for your brother and sister growing up?
The only expectations they had was just this nebulous idea that you had to do good in school. But that's about it. When it came to actual execution, they didn't know what to do. My mom, she dropped out of school here in the United States at ninth grade so she could pick strawberries. My dad, he had to drop out of school in fourth grade down in Mexico so he could take care of cows. So by the time I got to high school, my senior year, my mom would be the one who would say, oh, you should do good in school, but they couldn't help me in my homework. My dad, on the other hand, he wanted me to be a truck driver just like him. But when I told him I didn't want to do that, he got upset and said I was just going to waste my time in college. But thanks to me going to college and me setting that example of success, when it came to my two younger sisters and now my younger brother, my dad has insisted to all of them, you folks are not going to do anything unless you do your homework, unless you get good grades, and unless you go to a four-year university. So my dad, even though at first, initially, he didn't have an idea of how to succeed in this country through education, now he definitely is on the ball.
I know that you're very close to your parents. I'm curious, though. You know, there's the distance that would exist because you've grown up fully in this country, and your parents had sort of a back and forth, from Mexico to the U.S. And I have to wonder if the education thing is also a bit of a cultural divide within your family.
Not anymore. As I said earlier, it's funny. I'm not the only one that's had this experience. For my older cousins as well, they had that experience where the first one of the family, they were told, you have to go to work. College is just a waste of an education. But once my aunts and uncles and my parents, they learned through our example, for the younger generation now, they're expected to go to school. They're expected to get a college education and so forth. And I've found that also with Mexican immigrants in general. It's always a first, the firstborn is always a petri dish for this American experience that these immigrants are going to have to go through. And there's a lot of funny stories, but there's also a lot of stories that just make you grit your teeth or just wince. But when it comes to the children, the children that follow, they tend to be even more Americanized than their older brothers and sisters.
Did you have an inordinate amount of influence in your family in terms of consumer decisions and interpreting for your parents? I know they both speak English, but not as fluently, certainly, as you and your siblings do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, translating for the doctor, translating for an insurance agent. We from a young age, especially myself and the sister that follows me, Elsa, we got to learn English even faster than we would have just by going to school, by going to all these places and serving as an intermediary and also explaining stuff to my parents. Now, that said, my parents, they knew what they had to do. They knew they had to pay taxes and they knew they had to make payments on the house that we eventually moved into. So they weren't dummies by any sense of the definition. But we, even to this day, we still serve as those conduits between my immigrant parents and American culture in general. But they have learned over the years.
Now, what's a family dinner like at your house, Gustavo? I know that your parents prefer to speak Spanish. The younger generations typically prefer English. And I guess there's probably a lot of back and forth conversations in both languages.
Well, amongst the children, we speak English. To our parents, we always speak Spanish. Though, you know, once in a while, they'll just joke around with us and speak in English. But we speak in Spanish. But a typical Arellano dinner, let's see, spaghetti one night, enchiladas the next night, and macaroni the following night. So my mom, she cooks a little bit of everything, and she likes to combine all the dishes. So to have spaghetti with pinto beans, it's perfectly fine in our household.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to language and your siblings, one of the things I know that you didn't really have was a formal instruction in Spanish. So it was your first language, your mother tongue. And there's been a time or two that it's backfired on that you weren't sort of formally instructed. For example, when you went on the Colbert Show.
The only F I've ever received in my entire life, at least in college, was when I had to take a Spanish course, and it was a grammar course. So they said, identify the article, the preposition, in Spanish. And I failed it because I had no idea how to dissect the Spanish language. It was just like, what? I just know how to speak it. Similarly, when I went on the Colbert Report back in 2006, Colbert asked me what the Spanish word for patience was. And I said it was paciencia. And actually, it's paciencia. That's how you officially pronounce it in Spanish. And after going on the Colbert Report, I got hundreds of emails from Latinos all across the country and the world, really, calling me a sellout and a fake Mexican because I didn't know how to pronounce it.
Like, because of this one word, a fake Mexican.
Exactly. Well, yeah, no, because I just didn't put in the I in paciencia. Mm-hmm. I forgot the paciencia part. But the problem is, my parents, growing up, they're from rural Mexico, from the state of Zacatecas, all the way up in the mountains. We'd basically be considered Mexican hillbillies. They've been pronouncing paciencia as paciencia their entire life. So that's what I learned. In fact, you hear my dad speak Spanish amongst the more, the people I call the custodians of Cervantes, they'd ridicule his Spanish. They'd say, oh, you speak Spanish like a poor person. Just like people in the United States, they tend to make fun of Texans for saying y'all and just speaking a different type of English. But for that, you know, I have encountered some interesting situations, but whatever. My Spanish is my Spanish.
What kind of person writes to you and asks a question of the Ask a Mexican?
Every type of person. And here locally in Dallas, it comes out in the Observer. So I get questions from all across the country, from all age groups, from all ethnic groups, all economic groups, and, you know, all people based on from genuine curiosity to just a lover of all things Mexicans to bona fide racists who have no problem saying that they're racist and they're just trying to get a rise of myself and my readers.
Do you make a distinction between what I guess we could call benign ignorance and the kind that feels really deliberately mean?
Oh, yeah. You could tell based on the question. I've been doing the column now for 4 years, so I know that I can read the soul, so to speak, of the people who are asking the questions just by the way they structure it, by some of the word choices that they use. And, yeah, sometimes people are ignorant. Sometimes people are just genuinely curious. They really have no idea. Like, to that example, the best question that would testify to that is people always want to know why does so much Mexican music sound like German music, umpa music, or polka music. People aren't being racist when they ask that question, or even ignorant. They genuinely do not know why it sounds like that. So when it comes to questions like that, I treat it with the respect that it deserves. In other words, the respect of somebody who really is just genuinely curious. But when it comes to the real racist questions, well, I treat them with what they deserve as well. In other words, hitting them as hard as possible, but doing it in a way that will show the person to be more of a moron than me trying to be aggressive and just being too whiny.
Gustavo Arellano is my guest. He writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican that appears locally in the Dallas Observer. His new book is called Orange County, A Personal History. We'll return to our discussion in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is syndicated columnist Gustavo Arellano. He writes the Ask a Mexican column, and he also has a new book out called Orange County, A Personal History. It's a mixture of a memoir of his own family's history in Orange County and of the county itself, and its changing demographics. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You know, one thing that's really interesting, I think, about the concept of the column, Gustavo, is that it would seem that in places like, you know, Dallas, Texas, anywhere in Southern California, there is no shortage of Mexicans to ask things. But I guess the brilliance of it is that many people are afraid to open their mouths and ask something. And I'm talking about the sincere people here, because they don't want to come across as being racist if they really aren't.
The entire column is a joke. It originally started in November 2004 because my boss gave me the idea to make fun of people in Orange County in general. In my Orange County book, I talk about how, or I make the argument that Orange County is the Mexican hating capital of the United States.
Yeah, you said that's the religion, the official faith of Orange County.
Yeah, that's our official county religion. We started the Minuteman Project. You know, Farmers Branch, it would be perfect in Orange County. In fact, they just want to rip us off, but they just can't do it. But anyways, in covering immigration in Orange County, I did every possible angle that I could. And so finally, my boss said, let's just make up a column. Orange County is so ignorant when it comes to Mexicans. It's the only place in the country that probably needs an advice column where people really have their concerns about Mexicans, that they would need an advice column. So let's just do it one time and make a joke out of it, just as a satirical commentary on the state of Mexican relations in Orange County. What we didn't expect, though, was for people to take us seriously. And then once that happened, I just said, you know, my boss said, let's just go with it as far as possible. So now, really, the column will always have those same satirical roots, but it really has evolved to a place where if you have a question about Mexicans, I'll answer it. But again, depending on how serious or stupid the question is, I'm going to answer it with the respect that it deserves.
And a lot of what you do now is actually research-based.
Oh, from the very beginning, it was research-based. And granted, the first couple of them were joke columns and so forth, but I remember there was a second. The first ever question was, why do Mexicans call white people gringos? And the second question was, why do Mexicans hate gays so much? And even for that second question, I went into stats showing, and at that point, it was just for Orange County. I went into stats showing like the percentage of Latinos in the state of California that voted against or voted for a resolution that would define marriage as between a man and a woman in California. I had to dig up those stats. And the reason I did that is because at heart, I'm a reporter. I'm still an investigative reporter with the OC Weekly. Immigration and religion and really boring stuff like redevelopment, they still remain my bread and butter. So all I know is how to research and then use that research into writing pithy articles.
We should explain, by the way, because this is one of your most famous answers, that Mexicans don't call gringos gringos.
Well, the very first answer I gave to that question, again, since I thought it was just supposed to be a joke, I made sure that people could get that it was a joke. So I said that Mexicans don't call gringos gringos, only gringos call gringos gringos, and Mexicans call gringos gabachos. Obviously, in my answer, I already contradicted myself, and that was supposed to be the point. But at the same time, if I could teach white people a new word of how Mexicans use to disparage them, might as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ed in Arlington. Hey, Ed.
Hi. Well, speaking of gabachos, I was wondering what exactly is a gabacho? And secondly, my second question is North American Anglo Society has various heroic environmentalists that we greenie, we tree huggers look to, like in California, you're probably familiar with John Muir.
Yeah.
Or maybe Henry David Thoreau on the East Coast and Rachel Carson. I was wondering if there are any great Hispanic environmentalists that you could provide us with.
Yeah, definitely. I'll answer the second question first. In the United States, there has been Latino environmentalists, but they've been working more in the fields of trying to make sure that in urban areas they don't get as much pollution as possible. In Los Angeles, there was a whole organization of mothers in East Los Angeles that campaigned against an incinerator being built in the heart of East Los Angeles. In Mexico itself, there's been a lot of environmentalists. I don't know their names. I'm not too familiar with the Green Movement, or rather with the names and individuals of the Green Movement, but they've been instrumental in protecting the sea turtle down in the Sea of Cortez, the jungles over in the Yucatan. And especially recently, as Mexico has gone through more development, there has been more and more environmentalists on there. Now, as to what gabacho means, gabacho is actually a term originating in the Pyrenees, and it was used by Spaniards to make fun of the French people that would go over to Spain, and no one could understand them. So gabach originally meant somebody who doesn't speak well. So that term, though, eventually got exported over to Mexico, and that was also used to make fun of the French there during the occupation during the 1860s. Once the French left, then that term was then used against any invading Europeans at the time. That would only be Americans. And so that just stuck as a synonym for gringo. But I love the word gabacho because not only are we calling white people, we're also calling them French. So it's a double insult wrapped into one.
Of all the stereotypes, Gustavo, that you're confronted with, the one that really seems to bother you is that Mexican immigrants are not interested in assimilation. Can you talk about why that one particularly rankles?
It rankles me because it's just not based in any truth at all. And it also shows the unfortunate ignorant spot that the United States has, Americans have toward immigrants and its history. My all-time favorite question, it's in my Ask a Mexican book, and somebody once asked me, why don't Mexicans ever learn English? Are they too stupid or lazy? Can't they learn two or three words a day? And my response was very simple. I said that the United States government shares your concerns to this guy. It released a study that showed that this new wave of immigrants are really dumb. They're not learning English. They only come into this country to make money and send it back. They don't care at all about assimilation, and we should really clamp down on immigration. That's what people are saying about Mexicans nowadays, that somehow Mexicans are the only group that could possibly do that. But that report was called the Dillingham Report, and it appeared in 1911. And those idiot immigrants at the time were Italians, basically Eastern and Southern Europeans. So this myth that somehow immigrants of the past immediately assimilated, it's an absolute lie. And same thing with Mexicans. As I always tell people in lectures, as a member of the invading Mexican army, I could tell you that Mexicans are not trying to take over this country, that in fact, Mexicans will eventually become Americans. And within one generation, the immigrants, I understand if they can't learn English fast, because, hey, learning a language when you're an adult, it's kind of hard. But the children, people of my generation, we learn it effortlessly and we learn it immediately. It does happen.
Can you talk for a minute about the tension between immigrants who have been born here or their families have been here for some time and then people who have just crossed over?
Absolutely. It's another part, again, of American immigrant tradition, of the new immigrants coming in, having to deal with the previous wave of immigrants. It happened with the Protestant Irish versus the Catholic Irish. And with the Mexicans, it happens between Mexicans who might be here a couple of generations who are a little bit more well-to-do, and the Mexicans who just come here, yesterday or so forth. And so and it goes both ways, because the more assimilated Mexicans, they'll just call the less assimilated Mexicans Mexicans. But those new Mexican immigrants, they'll call the more assimilated Mexicans pochos, which is basically saying you're an Americanized Mexican. It's just part of human nature to make fun of those who are not like you. And especially with the United States, it's just part of an immigrant tradition to make fun of other immigrants.
Do you think that's part of the assimilation process?
Absolutely. One of the things that I always talk about my Ask a Mexican column being is part of American ethnic humor. And American ethnic humor has a long, proud tradition of making fun of your own community while at the same time using your humor so others can understand you. But one of the hallmarks of American ethnic humor is to make fun of other immigrants. That's why we've always had Irish jokes and Polish jokes, and currently we have Mexican jokes. It's just part of, I'm not saying it's a good part, but it is a part of American immigrant traditions.
I know that there are people within the Mexican-American community that are really bothered that you engage in any of those jokes. Does that criticism sting a little bit?
No, not at all. Not at all. I understand where they're coming from. They're the type of people who say, when it comes to hate and stereotypes, that we shouldn't even dignify them with responses. But again, going back to my background as an investigative journalist, one of the things I also do is track hate groups. And the best way to combat hate groups and hate, in my opinion, is to shine a light on them, is to put them out there in the open and show how ridiculous they are, especially when it comes to stereotypes. All stereotypes are people trying to make a truth out of one example. All you have to do is show a counterexample, and that stereotype bubble pops. That's what I try to do again and again and again. Good people can disagree with my approach, but in the 4 years that I've been doing this column, I've found that my approach is much more powerful than just doing straightforward opinion pieces, which I think also have their place and time. But with my column, at least through me, I've been able to have much more success at fighting the very hate that most people of all type, you know, of all ethnicities want to combat.
Gustavo Arellano writes the syndicated Ask a Mexican column. His new book is called Orange County, A Personal History. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. And we have next Susan on the line from Arlington. Hey, Susan.
Hi. This is a great program. I have to tell Gustavo first that I would have failed with Colbert as well, because when he talked about the Spanish word for patience, I said out loud in my car, paciencia. And that's from someone who teaches Mexican-American studies. So my question is this. Some of the recent polling data has really startled me in that likely Hispanic voters are now supporting Obama over McCain 66% to 23%.
Wow.
Now, I was wondering how, if at all, you think that reconciles with the stereotype, the anecdote, that there's a lot of competition with and even prejudice against African-Americans in the Mexican-American community.
It's funny because during the Democratic presidential primary, all you would hear from the mainstream media is that Mexicans will never, or Latinos, but specifically Mexicans, would never vote for a black man. And that was spread actually by the Hillary Clinton campaign in a, it was an interview with the New Yorker. And so my argument was, no, Mexicans will vote for a black man. Obviously, even if Hillary was getting 2/3 of the vote, that still means 1/3 of the Latino population was voting for Obama. And now that it's 2/3 voting for McCain, it really doesn't surprise me. When it comes to politics, Latinos will vote with those people who they think will give them will be the better candidate, just like any other American. Now, in terms of prejudice and competition, it does exist. Competition will always exist amongst minority communities, and it's always been a part, again, of American immigrant traditions, of immigrants coming in and basically, in some cases, literally brawling with the lower classes for jobs. The labor movements of the late 19th century and early 20th century, it mostly happened from immigrant workers unionizing to try to take to get the jobs from the more established American workers. When it comes to prejudice with Mexicans amongst African Americans, I always call it, I think there is a strain of prejudice in our community. I think it's a more benign type of prejudice, and it's something really born from popular culture down in Mexico that tends to treat Afro-Mexicans as little more than Sambo, step and fetch caricatures, but nothing so insidious as what's up here in the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Roger in Garland. Hello, Roger.
How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to make a few comments to your guest and have him respond to them. First of all, there is valid criticisms. You can always wrap it around hate. It's a hate group. It's a prejudice group. Well, and that's supposed to tend to discredit any valid arguments. For example, I'll give you a few myself. I don't want a bifurcation of a language in this country. I do resent and hate the fact that this country has to print ballots and every other thing, both in English and Spanish, and in many when it gets to be a predominant culture or a number of Spanish in a particular community. English or English American, in other words, can't even get a job there unless they are bilingual and they can speak Spanish to speak to their predominant maybe customers that come in the store. So that's slowly suffocating employment among Americans.
Well, let's give Gustavo a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, first off, I've never been bothered with bilingual ballots or trilingual or anything of that. It just, I don't know, maybe it's just because I grew up speaking both languages. It's just something that's never bothered me because, to me, English is always going to be the primary language of the United States. Even these immigrants know it. This idea that somehow immigrants, and specifically Mexicans, don't want to learn another language, it's just not true. You go to these English language classes, they're packed with all these immigrants. So that doesn't bother me. And then in terms of having to speak two languages to get a job, it really depends on what the job is. And if there's a job that does require bilingualism, then, well, so be it. Then learn the other language. And if you can't get that job, then go find another job.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Do you think, Gustavo, that some of people's concerns about language has to do with there's a strange, for people who don't understand a single word of another language, people have a tendency to think that whoever is speaking something different is talking about them.
That's so typically American arrogance. Whenever I go...
Yeah, it's all about us, right?
It is. It really is. Orange County has the largest community of Vietnamese outside of Vietnam in the world. Whenever I go, and I love going, the region's called Little Saigon, and I like going there. I have friends there. I like to go eat and shop there. And I don't understand any Vietnamese. I know how to speak many Vietnamese, so I know what a chicken is and beef and so forth like that, but I don't assume that everybody's talking about me. And also, it doesn't bother me that in some places I can't speak English. If I want to go to a place where I know I'm going to speak English, then I'll go to those places. But similarly, if you're going to go to a Latino community, for the most part, you're probably going to hear people who speak Spanish. The American ethnic enclave, again, it's a part of American culture, and people seem to forget that again and again. When we had Chinatowns, well, people only spoke Chinese there. Or the Lower East Side, when people spoke Yiddish and all the different languages, people at that point had a problem with it as well. But what else can you expect from these immigrants? These immigrants come into this country, they want to learn English, but they're not going to learn it immediately. So they're probably going to group together and live in a place where they could, for the most part, approximate their old life. But at the same time, it's just a stepping stone to becoming more assimilated and more American.
We have an email from Buddy in Fort Worth who says, why do on-air Hispanic media types who otherwise have a flat American accent pronounce their names with Mexican accents?
It's funny because somebody emailed me this direct question today, and I don't think they were from the Dallas area, but I get this again and again. People just want their names pronounced correctly. Like, I would be upset if, for instance, if you pronounce my last name Arellano. I mean, I wouldn't be really upset, but I'd be, come on, know how to speak or, you know how to pronounce my name. It's the same thing whenever if a Vietnamese language or somebody, a Vietnamese reporter, has a last name of Nguyen, N-G-U-Y-E-N, I'm not going to pronounce it Nguyen. It's just common courtesy, and it's these reporters who also want people to know that this is the way you pronounce it. I know sometimes they do too much of a flourish, like Gustavo Arellano or something like that, but whatever, at that point they're just having fun.
My guest is Gustavo Arellano. His book is called Orange County, A Personal History. He writes the syndicated Ask a Mexican column. You can ask him more in just a moment by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gustavo Arellano. He writes the syndicated Ask a Mexican column that appears locally in the Dallas Observer. His new book is called Orange County, A Personal History. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Bernadette writes from Fort Worth, I found myself at different stages in life identifying as a Mexican in grade school, then through college as a Mexican American, when participating with Latino groups that included Puerto Rican and Central and South Americans as Hispanic or Latino. She says, I don't have a preference anymore, but I've noticed that some others do have issues with these labels. How do you identify yourself?
I identify myself as a nerd, absolutely. When it comes to ethnic labels, there's so many. I've really come to the conclusion in my column that people could call themselves whatever they want. They're obviously going to have to answer to other people, but if you want to call yourself Chicano or Latino or Hispanic, go for it. There are some differences. A Hispanic would be anybody who could claim heritage to the Iberian Peninsula. In other words, that would include Portugal and Angola. Yeah, Angola even, and of course, Brazil and Spain. A Latino would be anybody from Latin America as opposed to the rest of America. And of course, Mexican-American and Chicano is people of Mexican heritage who were born in the United States. But if you're a Mexican of Mexican heritage and want to call yourself Mexican, even though you've been in the United States for 10 generations, go for it. If you just want to call yourself American, hey, that's fine as well.
Do you feel a lot of pressure as the Mexican in your columns to sort of answer for all of your people?
Oh, no. It's called Ask a Mexican, not the Mexican. But I know, even though I assume the persona of the Mexican, again, it's very much a satirical commentary. And it's my perspective. I'm going to answer whatever questions people may have with, all the facts and all that stuff. But my, as I tell people, the opinions, they're mine. The attempts at humor, they're mine. But the facts, they're the facts. And I don't own those facts. And if people want to be their own commentator, please. In fact, I think there needs to be more voices out there talking about the Mexican-American community. There's nearly not enough, especially in this media landscape or even in the blogosphere. We need more Latino bloggers out there, many, many more. There's a lot of great ones out there, but we need many, many more.
But certainly you're aware of the influence that you might have on people.
I do. In my most arrogant moments, I do. As a reporter, you always have to, or a columnist, you always have to write with the assumption that people are probably not going to pay attention to you. And if they do, then that's great. But even if they don't, well, you just have to keep putting out your articles out there. You have to keep putting out your opinions and make sure that they'll be able to withstand the test of time or the test of criticism. I don't write to try to get an audience. I do try to influence people. I do try to let people know that really Mexicans are no different from any other humans. I think that's a cliched point personally, but it's something that needs to be told again and again, especially in this current political landscape.
Let's go next to Veronica in Dallas. Hello, Veronica.
Hola. Hi.
Hola.
Gustavo, mucho gusto.
No, usted, gracias por hablar.
Gustavo, I wanted to, you know, I was driving and I had to stop because I was very, very happy to hear about your book.
Oh, thank you.
I am a professor of Spanish in Southern Methodist University, and this is a tendency that has started many, many years ago. As you know, nowadays there are a lot of courses, and this is throughout all American universities, where we really deal with the Latino student, to say the one that speaks Spanish but has never had formal kind of learning.
Yeah.
So I do that, and I have to tell you, I was born, raised in Mexico. I came here when I had already finished my college. So I have lived here ever since, and it's been over half of my life. But the most, my contribution, I think, to this country and has been to teach the heritage students, because of the terminology that is used, to make them recover in a way the lack of self-esteem that they bring when they come to the classroom and say, oh, no, mi español no es bueno, my Spanish is no
yeah.
good. And I always say, well, let's start, who says so? I mean, let's start talking about it. And in this classroom, since all of them have the same, a similar background, let's say, you cannot imagine the memoirs, the explosion of feelings, Gustavo,
mm-hmm.
that happens every semester, because, as you know, my life goes in semesters.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that. And there's also, again, this stereotype that somehow, even if the children of Mexican immigrants are born in the United States, that they're always going to remain Mexicans, that they're always going to remain fluent in Spanish, and not at all. Once a Mexican child is born in this country, it's really a battle for them to retain as much of their Spanish and as much of their heritage as possible, because the influence of American culture, it's so great that it will chip away at that. So a lot of times when Mexican or Chicano students go to college, they love going there because they get to learn a lot about their heritage. They get to learn Spanish much more better. And a lot of them, they do come with these shameful feelings of their Mexican roots.
You talk about your family's influence on you now, and you don't have time to go to as many family gatherings as you used to. But you did. You lived at home until you were in, I guess, your mid-20s.
Oh, just 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So I'm 29. I moved out when I was 27, and a lot of Americans view me like a perverted person or something like that.
Well, you had bunk beds with your brother.
Yeah,
right?
Bunk beds with my brother. My response is, I never had a problem with it. In fact, I would have still be living at home if it wasn't for the fact that now I'm on the road so much. But it's just part of Mexican culture to be as close with your family as possible. I still visit my parents 2 or 3 times a week, spending hours there at a time, and I don't have a problem with it. In fact, I have a problem with most Americans talking to their parents maybe once a month or seeing them once or twice a year just for the major holidays. I view that as just detrimental, really, to the family unit in this country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Katie in Wiley. Hey, Katie.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question about Mexican, I guess, stereotypes. And I don't think of myself as a really prejudiced person, but I've had a lot of experiences with, like, Mexican men gawking, like, hollering and stuff. And I was just wondering if that's something culturally that maybe you could shed some light on, or if you have any ideas of how to respond, because I just feel myself seeing a group of Mexican men and not wanting to walk by, but don't want to be prejudiced at the same time. So I just thought you might help me understand a little.
Well, you know, put them in their place. Tell them that it's not right. I don't condone that at all. I know what you're talking about also. That's one of the most ask questions. And, you know, my response to that, it's somewhat cultural. It is. Mexican men try to pass themselves off as macho men, but I would say most men try to do that. But especially once if you're an immigrant man, you're also, you almost have like a heightened sense of masculinity in this country, just trying to show yourself off as being a man. But don't stand for it. Just tell them, don't do that. That's disrespectful. Or if all else fails, just shout La Migra and they'll start running.
By the way, you played La Migra as a kid where other kids played cops and robbers.
Well, we're a Mexican kid. The great thing with kids, at least we used to be great. I think now kids, most of them can't even play recess. But we just decided to create a game called La Migra where one group of kids, and we were all Mexicans, by the way, one group of kids would play, quote-unquote, Mexicans. The other group would be immigration officials, and we'd just start chasing each other. It was half hide-and-go-seek, half tag, and half Red Rover. It was a lot of fun.
Back for a minute to the stereotype about Mexican men and machismo, because this even comes up in the book. It does seem to go, that manifests itself in two ways. You write that you were raised to be so respectful of women that you would have to, you know, ask a date before you so much as kissed her. And you know, there are a lot of Mexican men who are opening doors and sort of, if not deferential, very respectful of women.
Yeah.
Is it unfair to assume that most of it's about catcalling and about being the toughest guy in the room?
Mexican culture draws a lot on Spanish culture. On the culture of Spain. So chivalry is really the name of the game when it comes to that. So, you know, and of course, since we're also Catholic, we also get to suffer with the Madonna horror complex, where you either see women as Madonnas, as pure and, you know, virginal, or basically as whores. So unfortunately, you do see that manifest itself with a lot of Mexican men, where you will be courteous, you will be respectful in one sense, but sometimes that doesn't mean you're above just whistling or wolf whistling at a woman at the same time. So just a jumbled psyche, just like Mexicans are, just like all people are.
We have an email from Gerardo in Allen. He says, as a Mexican-American, I grew up in the late 60s, being very cognizant that that I be accepted, whether language that his accent was heavily Spanish accented when he spoke English.
Uh-huh.
He says, my pet peeve is when people call me Spanish, referring to language as opposed to culture. Does that bother you?
Yeah, that's just funny. Again, people are only learning now about all the distinctions between Latinos, and so for a long time, a lot of people would call people of any Latino culture, oh, you're Spanish culture, you're Spanish-speaking culture, or if you go back east, a lot of times you'll see Mexican food referred to as Spanish food. So it does bother me, but I don't see it. If people are going to call you Spanish, it's not because they're racist. It's just because, as you said earlier, they're benignly ignorant. So in that case, I just gently correct them. I don't take too much offense, but I will correct them.
Let's speak next to Jose in Arlington. Hi, Jose.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. Well, it's kind of a comment and a question, and I heard Gustavo talk about assimilation and about heritage, and as we become more American, as he says, have we lost our culture because of this new border issues we're having and all the regulations they're trying to have on the border? Is that one thing? And as well, is it because maybe there isn't enough history being taught? Is that why we're forgetting our heritage and our culture and actually leaving our people behind instead of allowing them the opportunity that our forefathers gave us?
Well, you know, towards that, there is a lot of heritage being left, lost, or even suppressed. In my Orange County book, I talk a lot about just the different suppressed histories of Orange County, a lot of it Mexican-American history. And it's done specifically because if you tell that perspective, it's going to shed a much different light on the American history that was taught to people. I don't think the border issue has anything to do with that, though. I think what the border issue shows is that Americans, and not just, you know, there are some Mexican-Americans who do agree with the border or tougher immigration. But what that shows is just the xenophobic strain in our mind that we get again and again and again. And it's funny because the Border Patrol, it's only a recent phenomenon in American history. It was only started around the 1920s, and it was started actually to keep away the Chinese from entering the country, not the Mexicans.
We have an email from Eva who read your points column on Sunday in the Morning News and says, would you clarify your obvious contradiction in the article? You appear gleeful and proud of your father's illegal entry, but then say you do not advocate uncontrolled immigration.
I don't think it's contradictory at all. I was proud that my dad came into this country illegally because, to me, that shows a lot of courage on his part, because I would not stuff myself into the trunk of a Chevy. I don't support an open border where anybody could come in, not at all. I do support much more liberal immigration policy, but I still see that as being accepting of allowing people in there. I don't support illegal immigration at all. I think we should know everybody who comes into the country. At the same time, I understand why people come into this country illegally. I frankly, for the most part, I sympathize with them as long as they're like my parents were, or like most of the illegal immigrants that I know who come in, they work, and they stay out of trouble.
You have written, I have seen the Mexican future of this country, and it is absolutely banal. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. Again, there's way too much hype about us Mexicans. Some people say that we're trying to take over the United States, specifically the Southwest. Some people say that we're just ruining everything. A lot of people say we don't tip properly. There's just way too much fuss about us. And really, Mexican immigrants and their descendants, they're going to be as boring as Americans as anybody else. And my family is proof. When I have children, I'm going to try to teach them how to speak Spanish as well and have pride in their Mexican culture. But I know the truth. Assimilation always wins, and it wins big time in this country. And anybody who thinks otherwise, they're as deluded as a Minuteman.
You are, according to the way demographers break things out, you're at the very upper end of this generation of Americans that's expected to not really have problems with race the way everyone who is older does. Do you think that that's possible looking around at your friends?
Oh, yeah. Almost all my friends, growing up at least, we all came from the same background. Our parents were immigrants. Some of them came to this country illegally, and they still, to this day, mostly speak Spanish. When we entered kindergarten, the only language we spoke was Spanish, and now we're all either blue-collar or white-collar workers, perfectly assimilated, speaking English mostly to ourselves, but speaking Spanish to our elders. And, you know, we don't have a problem with other immigrants. We don't have a problem, as the previous caller did, with bilingual ballots or bilingual, you know, or people speaking different languages. We just accept that as a part of life because we know that ultimately a country is not created or is not successful based on the fact that everybody speaks, you know, multiple languages. That's not its downfall. The strength of the country is that everybody has a shared vision to better themselves and better their communities. And that's what all immigrants, for the most part, have.
Gustavo Arellano writes the nationally syndicated column Ask a Mexican. His new book is called Orange County, A Personal History. Gustavo, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
No, gracias a ti.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.